there was a formula that when I was a hostage negotiator that was given to us in terms of how we deliver a message. And that formula was 7-38-55. 7% of your message is delivered by the words that you use. 38% of it was delivered by the tone of voice you used with those words. And then 55% of it was delivered by your body language or facial expressions.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok.
My guest today is Terry Tucker. Here's three facts that I think you should know about Terry. One, he was a SWAT team hostage negotiator with the Cincinnati Police Department. Two, he has trained with the FBI's hostage negotiation team. And three, he is the author of the book Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. Terry Tucker, welcome to Your Intended Message.
George, thanks for having me on Your Intended Message. I'm really looking forward to talking with you today.
I'm delighted to be talking with you, and I'm sure glad I don't have to negotiate with you over anything, because I know I'd lose right off the bat.
I don't know about that.
Terry, your book, Sustainable Excellence, what prompted you to put that in writing?
Yeah, Sustainable Excellence is really a book that was born out of two conversations that I had. I used to be one of the many jobs I had in my life. I used to be a former high school girls basketball coach when we lived in Texas. And I had one of my players had moved to the area in Colorado where my wife and I live with her fiance. And the four of us had dinner one night. And I remember saying to her after dinner that I was excited that she was living close and I could watch her find and live her purpose. And she got real quiet for a while. And then she looked at me and she said, well, coach, what do you think my purpose is? I said, I have no idea what your purpose is, but that's what your life should be about. Finding the reason you were put on the face of this earth, using your unique gifts and talents and living that reason. So that was one conversation. And then I had a young man reach out to me from college on social media and asked me what I thought were the most important things he should learn, not to just be successful in his job or in business, but to be successful in life. And, you know, George, I didn't want to give him that, you know, get up early, work hard, help others kind of, not that those aren't important. Those are incredibly important. I wanted to see if I could go deeper with him. So I spent some time taking some notes and eventually had these 10 thoughts, these 10 ideas, these 10 principles. And so I sent them to him. And then I stepped back and I was like, you know, I got a life story that fits underneath that principle, or I know somebody whose life emulates this principle. So literally, I've been battling cancer for 11 years. After I had my leg amputated and before I started chemotherapy, I had a 3 or 4 month period where I was healing. I sat down at the computer every day and I built stories, and they're real stories about real people underneath each of the principles. And that's how Sustainable Excellence came to be.
And Terry, you lost your leg because of cancer. So I guess that's the end of basketball for you. I can't see you hopping around on one leg. And I'm guessing that's also the end of police work for you as well.
Yes, I had been out of police work a few years before I developed cancer, but I was actually a high school basketball coach when I had this callus break open on the bottom of my foot, and not thinking much of it, let it go for a few weeks, but eventually went to see a podiatrist and was diagnosed with a rare form of melanoma. Most people think of that as too much exposure to the sun. My form has nothing to do with sun exposure. It's just a rare form that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands.
Terry, when you received that diagnosis, did you do the typical, why me? Why me?
Yeah, that's a great question, George. And I think I went through all the stages initially that we would associate with grief. You know, first it was denial. I can't possibly have cancer. I've done everything right. And then you sort of get mad. I can't possibly have cancer. I've done everything right. You know, and then you get to a point where there was bargaining. You know, our daughter was in high school at the time, and it was like, okay, God, just let me live long enough to see her graduate from high school. And then I got a little down, a little depressed. And then I just got to a point where it was like, you know, this sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace the suck, for lack of a better word. I don't like these cards that I've been dealt, but I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And you know, I've seen so many people, and I'm sure you have too, that, you know, they start down the road toward a goal or something that they want. And then they butt up against an impediment. Something gets in their way and they can't get over it, around it, through it. So they quit. But we just don't quit. We got to blame somebody. You know, we got to blame our parents or our boss or our station in life. Very few people take personal responsibility for their own success and happiness. And so I never asked why. I mean, people were asking me when I found out that I had cancer and that I have a faith life. It's like, well, first of all, who do you blame? Like, well, I don't blame anybody because I got cancer. And then it was like, well, you must blame God. And I used to joke with them. I'm like, no, I don't think God got up on a Tuesday morning, checked his to-do list and said, hey, Terry Tucker, cancer today. I don't believe that at all. But I do believe that he has given me the strength to move forward in this 11-year battle.
Whatever the battle, where do we find that strength? How do we find it? And more importantly, how do we recognize it as a strength instead of just another thing putting us down?
I think one of the things that I learned, and you can't tell this from looking at me or from my voice, but I'm 6'8" tall, and I played college basketball at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. And one of the things that team sports taught me, at least, and like I said, I started playing basketball when I was 9 years old and played all the way up till I was 21. And what team sports taught me was the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. You realize that on a team, that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, et cetera. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. So instead of thinking, you know, oh, woe is me. And don't get me wrong, I have bad days. There are days I do get down. But instead of thinking about how terrible my circumstances are, when I get into those dark and ugly places, I find the best way to get out of that is to go help somebody else, to make a difference in somebody else's life. Now, all of a sudden, I'm not thinking about me. I'm projecting what I have or the goodness that I have on somebody else to make their life better. So I think it's just really kind of shifting the perspective. I don't know. I'd be interested in your thoughts on how you get people to sort of turn over that leaf and look at life in a different way.
Now, Terry, I'm intrigued by that idea that when, and we all get down, you know, we all get angry, all get frustrated. And however, one way to get through that is to look for a way to help someone else, because then we take our focus off our own situation and realize, well, I can still do something for someone else, however little it will be, but I can do something. And that's got to give positive thoughts and positive energy back to you.
It does. Exactly. Now all of a sudden, instead of thinking how bad my life is, I'm helping another individual. And so now you're not focusing on yourself, you're focusing on somebody else. And again, I think it goes back to being part of something that's bigger than you. This isn't just about you. This is about us collectively. And how can I make a difference, a positive difference, in another individual's life?
Terry, you teased us with that concept of 10 principles to live by. Can you reveal some of those to us?
Sure. I'll give a couple to you. These principles, I mean, this one is, it radiates with me. And the principles are not in any order. Number one is not any more important than number seven. But it's always fun for me as an author when somebody reaches out, because there's always one principle that resonates with them specifically. And I wrote all 10 of them, but I even have one that resonates with me, and it's this. Most people think with their fears and their insecurities instead of using their minds. And I know I've done that in my life, George. You know, I've been like, oh, I'd like to do this. Oh, wait a minute. You know, am I smart enough? Or do I have enough information? Or what will people think about me if I fail in this endeavor? That's thinking with our fears and our insecurities. That's not thinking with our minds. And I always tell, especially when I speak in person to young people, I always tell them, if there's something in your heart, something in your soul that you believe you're supposed to do, but it scares you, go ahead and do it. Because at the end of your life, the things you're going to regret are not going to be the things you did. They're going to be those things you didn't do. And by then, it's going to be too late to go back and do them. That's one. Another one that I really love is the importance of listening, you know, and having a, you know, your intended message, having what is that message? How is that message communicated? You know, the importance of listening. And I learned this as a hostage negotiator. I learned that there's a difference between listening to understand versus listening to reply. You know, it's like, all right, George, hurry up and say what you're going to say because I want to get my two cents in. That's listening to reply, as opposed to, okay, George, I hear what you're saying. I may agree with you. I may not agree with you, but help me to understand where you're coming from in delivering your message. So I think listening is incredibly important. And especially in today's society, we're so busy screaming at each other that not alone do we not hear each other, but we certainly don't understand where we're coming from when it comes to trying to deliver a message.
Listening, the silly phrase that people repeat, you know, we got two ears, one mouth, we should listen twice as much. And that's true. But that's not the reason why we have two ears.
Sure.
But it's just a good visual reminder that we do need to listen to others. And as you pointed out, we need to listen to understand, which is a lot different than simply recording information or just waiting impatiently for our turn. What do you say to yourself when you're listening to someone so that you stay focused and you look for their meaning, which might not come out in the words?
Yeah, so there was a formula that when I was a hostage negotiator that was given to us in terms of how we deliver a message. And that formula was 7-38-55. And I promise there's no math class here. I'm not going to ask you to do any math, George. So we're good here. But what that meant was 7% of your message is delivered by the words that you use. 38% of it was delivered by the tone of voice you used with those words. And then 55% of it was delivered by your body language or facial expressions. So you think about a police officer, 99% of what we did was face-to-face with another individual. So you could take those visual clues. If I was talking to you and you were kind of, you know, looking around, I might think, oh, George might be looking to run or to escape or something like that. Or, you know, if you're balling up your fist, oh, maybe George wants to fight me. I could see that and I could do something about it. I could handcuff you. I could sit you down. I could put you in my car, whatever was appropriate for why we were there. But as hostage negotiators, we didn't have that visual aspect of it. I was not with the person who was barricaded or who had taken hostages. So, you know, I might say something and I didn't see the person on the other end of the phone or on the other side of the door, you know, kind of roll their eyes like, oh no, what an idiot. I can't believe he said that. That's not what I'm talking about at all. So we had to figure things out based on what people were saying, what they weren't saying, and how they were saying it. And that was kind of a nuance. That was kind of an art that we had to sort of figure out. And I'll be honest with you, there were many times I went down a rabbit hole that the person was like, no, you idiot. You have no idea what I'm talking about. You know, and so you kind of have to try to regroup because, I mean, you're trying to develop a relationship with somebody that's in crisis that you have never met. And you really have to, the reason hostage negotiation is so exhausting is you kind of have to get down in the weeds with these people. You've got to get down to their level and practice what we used to call tactical empathy. And it goes back to what we're talking about listening. Help me understand where you're coming from. Not so that I'm going to agree with you. I mean, if you've just killed three people and are barricaded, you know, you can tell me your story, but I'm not going to agree that what you did was right. But it's an understanding of where you're coming from, which allows the two of us to make a connection. That connection leads to trust. And hopefully at the end of the negotiation, you come out safely.
And Terry, I heard an interesting point there that you can develop trust with a person, you can have empathy for a person without having to agree with them.
Yeah, and then people look at that and it's like, oh, you know, how do you do that? The way we did it is really by asking open-ended questions. We asked a lot of how and what questions. We tried to stay away from why questions because why sounds kind of accusatory. If I said to you, George, well, George, why did you do that? You might, oh, wait a minute. Is he looking to say, hey, I shouldn't have done that? Or I mean, does he agree with that? I mean, you're trying to figure out. But if I can get to the same thing by saying, what got us to this point, George? Or how do you see this resolving, George? Or whatever it is. And again, what that did was it built trust, but it also engaged you without even you realizing it, engaged you to help me get you out safely. How are we going to resolve this, George? That's just not me making the decisions. That's you. Oh, well, Terry wants to understand how we're going to resolve this. Okay, well, here, let me throw some stuff out. Let me do this. I mean, this is very oversimplified version of this, but it's the same kind of thing. I want to engage you to help me to get you and the hostages, if there are hostages, out safely. So how and what questions was a good way to do that when we were negotiating with somebody?
And how might that approach to negotiating apply to self-talk when faced with obstacles?
Yeah, that's a great question. We all talk to ourselves. Whether we like to admit it or not, we all talk to ourselves. And I've always cautioned people to be very careful with what you say to yourself. Because I'll give you an example. I talked about basketball before. If I took a basketball and I went out onto the court and I started to practice free throws, there would be a certain part of my brain that would engage. If we could look at it under an MRI, that would light up. If I thought about taking that basketball, going out onto the court and practicing those free throws, that exact same part of my brain would engage, or again, light up on an MRI. So I always caution people to be very careful what you say to yourself, because if you tell yourself, you know, if you're taking an algebra class and you're like, boy, I'm terrible in algebra, I'm no good in math, I'm not going to do it. If you say those negative things enough times, eventually those are going to get reinforced in your brain. And you're right, you're not going to be able to pass that class. So we need to be careful what we say to ourselves, because we all become what we think. And I think that's incredibly important. Bobby Knight, the basketball coach at Indiana University when I was growing up in Chicago, used to have a great quote. He said, mental is to physical as 4 is to 1. So here's this great coach teaching elite athletes to use their bodies to be great players on the court. But what he was really saying with that quote is that your mind or your mindset is 4 times more important to your overall success in life than anything your physical body's going to do.
In high school, I started running cross country long distance, and I was either the slowest or the second slowest guy on the team, but I kept showing up. And I dropped out of my first six mile race. I didn't even complete. I dropped out, but I kept sticking with running, and I still run today. And the interesting thing is, people would say, well, George, when are you going to run a marathon? Oh, I'll do it someday. I'll do it someday. 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 It's way down the road. I don't have to worry about it now. Fortunately, one day I decided to compete in a mini triathlon. And here's the mental thing, how it comes in. So there was a guy I knew from a networking group. He was asking for donations. You know, it was a fundraising thing. He was competing in it. And he asked me for money, and I signed up as a sponsor. But then I looked at him and I said, well, he doesn't look so great. If he could do it, so could I. And so I entered and I survived. Now, here's how positive leads to more positive. I completed, no great time, but you know, I completed it. And then I looked and I said, what else could I do? What else could I try? And that's when I discovered half marathons. And I thought, well, I'm not ready for a full marathon, but maybe a half. And at the time, it was only about twice as much as I was running at the time. So I completed a half marathon. And then the next thing, of course, is as soon as you fit, like you're running the race and you're thinking the whole time. And here's a point that I've seen you say before, or a tip that actually you posted, that you've got to go through bad until you get to good. And running the marathon, the whole time going through it, feeling bad. And then you cross the finish line, and then there's this joy and oh, wow, I see, I knew I could do it all the time. I always knew it. No, just 100 feet down the road, you were thinking you're never going to make it. And now you make it. So I see the point there is that it's about getting the momentum. A book I was reading recently about running, which was incredibly full of motivational messages. And one of the messages was, the first race for you as a runner is to get to the start line, to show up. Now, how does that resonate with the messages that you offer to people?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you you look at people who want to go to the gym, and as I just can't do it. It's like baby steps. It's the same way we learn to walk as children. Is you okay? The first day, I'm gonna pack all my stuff in a gym bag, and I'm just gonna put it in the corner. That's day one. Then the next day, it's okay. Maybe I'm gonna put the stuff on, but I'm still not gonna go to the gym. And then the next day, well, maybe I'll drive to the gym, but I'm not gonna go in. And you take those small baby steps until you get to the point where now I'm there. Now I'm doing something about it. And I remember the San Francisco 49 receiver, Jerry Rice, used to have a great quote. He said, "Today I will do what others won't so that tomorrow I can do what others can't." And it's those small things. It's just having a little bit of grit. And for some reason, I think people, we have social media and we have television and movies on, and we look at these people and they're like, you know, that's a great businessman. That's a great actor. That's a great singer. That's a great athlete. And we're like, oh my gosh, I could never be like them. So why even try? And what you don't see, I think of my wife and I have a daughter who unfortunately or fortunately got my height and went to the United States Air Force Academy on a basketball scholarship. But what people didn't see is all those days in the summer where she was in, you know, the hot, humid, stuffy gymnasium, putting up thousands and thousands and thousands of shots every day to get to the point where, yeah, now I'm going to college for free on a scholarship. And people seem to think that when we get to the pinnacle, when we get to the top of the mountain, when we're successful in life, that that's just happened for those people. And I always tell them the road to success is paved with failure. And I remember the quote from Nelson Mandela, the former president of South Africa, who said, "I never lose. I either win or I learn." And I think that's the important part of this message is that if you try things and you fail, you're not a failure unless you don't learn from them. But if you can learn something from that, if you can take something away, even if it's small, then you're better off today than you were yesterday. And this is going to sound kind of corny, but I'm going to tell you this anyway. I used to get in the mirror every night before I went to bed and look in the mirror and say, are you better today than you were yesterday? And if the answer to that question is yes, then today has been a successful day. No matter how many times I failed, no matter, you know, if we got beat in our game and I played terrible and all that, that's okay. Did I get better? Did I learn something? And if the answer is yes, then you're moving in the right direction. That's sort of the baby steps that I'm going to get better tomorrow. And we all seem to think that we're in competition with each other. We're not, you know, be happy for the guy who's got, you know, $1 million and has a great job and all that stuff. Well, I want what that person has. Now I'm jealous and stuff. No, you're on your own path. You're on your own. You have your own destiny to worry about. Be grateful for what that person has. Thank them, you know, smile at them, be grateful for what they did in life, but stay on your path and ask yourself every day, am I better today than I was yesterday? And if the answer is yes, you're moving in the right direction.
And I see a lot of value in that daily question conversation with oneself.
We try to control so many things that are outside of our purview, and that leads to stress and anxiety and things like that. And when I went to college at the Citadel, it was a military school. And one year we had a president of the college who was a retired admiral in the United States Navy. And he'd been a fighter pilot during the Vietnam War. His name was James Stockdale. And he was shot down during one of his missions. And he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war in the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam. And I didn't know how to have a lot of interaction with him. But I remember being at an event with him one time where somebody asked him, who survived that brutality, that torture? He said, well, let me tell you who didn't survive. He said, it wasn't the big, tall, strong, tough guys that thought that they could handle any amount of abuse or torture. And this one was interesting too. He said, it wasn't even the optimists that survived. The people who thought they'd be rescued or be let go by Thanksgiving or Christmas or Easter, and Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter would come and go, and they wouldn't be released. He said, and those people died of a broken heart. He said, the people that survived were the people that understood what they could control and controlled it. And he said, for us, it was pretty much the thoughts in our mind and the breathing in our lungs. Everything else was at the discretion of the enemy. When we ate, when we slept, when we were tortured, when we got exercise, when we got mail, everything else was at the discretion of the enemy. So understand in your life what you can control and control that. and not worry about all the extraneous things that we spend so much time worrying about that either never happen or that we have absolutely no control over. Understand what you can control and control that in your life. And I promise you, you'll be a whole lot happier.
Also valid point, a wonderful valid point, because we often spend a lot of time worrying about things we can't control, which is bound to get us depressed or frustrated or angry. And there's a lot of angry people out there.
Yeah, because they're overwhelmed. It's like, I've got all this that I think I need to do. No. What can you really control? What do you really have the ability to do something about? And the rest of it, let it go. That's hard to do in society today. We're bombarded with all, you need to have the latest and greatest. And George, the way I look at it is kind of like this. We seem to think that we are born empty and that our job, when we get out of school and we get into life, our job is to fill ourselves up. I got to get a great education. I've got to get a great job, drive a great car, have a great family, have all this stuff. And we fill ourselves up. And I've seen so many people do that. And those people are miserable. And what I've come to understand is that we're not born empty. We're born full. And we have everything inside of us that we need to be successful in life. So our job should be, instead of filling ourselves up, our job should be to empty ourselves out for the betterment of ourselves, our family, our neighborhood, our society, our God, whatever you believe. And I see the people that do that seem to be much more happier in their life than all those people who are constantly trying to have the latest and greatest and newest and best. Those people are never happy because there's always something newer or something better to pursue. No, what are your gifts and how can you empty those gifts out for the betterment of the society that we live in?
And so no matter what circumstances we find ourselves in, it's not a matter of glass half full or half empty. We are full. We simply need to recognize that. And perhaps we're too busy looking at other people and saying, oh, I wish I was more. Or our family tells us we should be like them. You should be like that, the neighbor. Look at the neighbor or look at your cousin. And really, they're different people. They're full of different things, different values.
They absolutely are. And I experienced that with my own father. I wanted to go into law enforcement. My grandfather had been a Chicago police officer from 1924 to 1954. He was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. It was not a serious injury. He was shot in the ankle. But when I expressed an interest in following in my grandfather's footsteps, my dad was, absolutely not. You're going to college. You're going to major in business. You're going to get out, get a great job, get married, have 2.4 kids and live happily ever after. But that's what my dad wanted me to do. That's not what I felt my purpose was. And my dad was dying of cancer when I graduated from college. So I had a choice. I could have been like, hey, sorry, Dad, I'm going to go blaze my own trail, or out of love and respect for you, I will do what you want me to do. And that's what I did. I went into business and I sort of joke, I did what every good son did. I waited till my father passed away and then I followed my own dreams. But my dad did what he did out of love for me. He wanted something better. He wanted, or at least what he thought was better. And I know people face that all the time in life. You just said that, somebody in your family, they're pushing you in this direction when you feel you're supposed to go in that direction. And I don't know, George, how would you feel if somebody said, hey, George, I know you want to do this podcast, but no, I don't want you to do that. I want you to do something over here. You'd have a decision to make. And sometimes that's not an easy decision when it's done out of love and, they want you to have a better life. It's not done out of malice. And that's even harder. I mean, if it's done out of malice, you can say, oh, no, they don't have my best interest in mind. But if it's done out of love, that makes that even harder. That's why I really think, like I said, those young people, something in your heart, something in your soul, you believe you're supposed to do, keep that alive, keep that flame alive. And eventually, I think you'll get to that point in your life.
Terry, people that might be interested in your book, Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life, they can find that book on Amazon, and you can find that link in the description below. Terry, who get the most out of that book?
I think anybody that's trying to find their place in life and find their purpose in life. Viktor Frankl, the former concentration camp survivor during World War II, used to talk about how we should not just kind of muddle through life, how we all have a purpose on this planet and our job should be to find that purpose and to live it. And so I think anybody that's struggling, anybody that's trying to figure out what that purpose is and how they go about doing it would get a great deal of it out of reading the book. I don't purport to have all the answers, George, but I like to think that, look, I've done some things in my life. I've learned some lessons, made some mistakes, and here's what I've learned from that. And I'm just offering that to you as maybe something that works. So I'm not the guru, the end all be all, but I've done some things in life that are pretty exciting and pretty fun in the course of, and even cancer. I mean, cancer has made me a better human being. And I know people, how the heck could that possibly be? It's made me appreciate the things in life that are really important. And so much of what we spend our time with are not really important things in life. Figure out what your purpose in life is and live it. And I promise you, at the end of your life, you're going to be a whole lot happier and you're going to have a whole lot more peace in your heart.
Yes. I discovered that my purpose wasn't to watch every episode on Netflix.
I think my daughter's is. So, I mean, that's
well, maybe it's a temporary thing. You have to go through that. Terry, before we wrap up, if you could sit down and talk to a business leader who is going through a period of transition or challenge or facing some obstacles, if you could sit down and you could help them perhaps with their daily talks to themselves, how might you guide that conversation? What one, two, or three pieces of advice might you offer them?
That's a great question, George. I guess let me answer that question with a story. I had a nurse recently ask me. I had my foot amputated in 2018 and my leg amputated in 2020. And she asked me, what was it like to lose your foot and to lose your leg? And I told her it certainly hasn't been easy. You know, when you're 6'8", learning to walk again, falling is not an option. You get hurt from this height, so falling is not an option. But what I told her was that cancer can take all my physical faculties, but cancer can't touch my mind, it can't touch my heart, and it can't touch my soul. And that's who I am. That's who you are, George. That's who everybody who's listening to us is. So what I would say, and I'm not going to tell you not to focus on, learning, and I'm not going to tell you not to focus on going to the gym and being a better leader and getting more rest and eating. I'm not going to tell you to do all the things physically that we know how to be successful in life. What I'd like to suggest is maybe every day, spend a little more time working on who you really are, your heart, your mind, and your soul. This body's going to go away. It's going to decay and not be here anymore. But our hearts, our minds, and our souls, those things are eternal. Those things live on forever. And I think as a leader, as an entrepreneur, as a businessman, whatever you want to say, we all want to leave an impact. We all want to have a legacy. And we think that legacy is our job or the money we make or anything like that. It's not. It's how you treat people. It's how you involve other people in your journey along the way and make their lives better. So spend a little more time every day working on your heart, working on your mind, and working on your soul.
Powerful advice. My guest today is Terry Tucker, reminding you that you were born full.
If you like what you heard, tell your friends and post your 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, because that helps more listeners find us. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.